Hello and welcome to the July 7th, 2026 Annals of Internal Medicine podcast. I hope people listening from the U.S. enjoyed a safe celebration of our country's 250th birthday. I'm Dr. Christine Lane, Annals Editor-in-Chief, and I'm looking forward to giving you a quick glimpse at what's new on annals.org. Because not all cervical in situ neoplasias grade 2 or CIN2 progresses to cervical cancer, appropriate management is a topic of debate. To inform this debate, researchers from the National Cancer Institute analyzed data from 12,012 women from the Kaiser Permanente California Cervical Cancer Screening Program diagnosed with CIN2 on initial biopsy between 2017 and 2023. Comparing immediate treatment defined as excision within 6 months with delayed management defined as continued surveillance or excision after 6 months. They estimated the 3-year risk of unnecessary excision, CIN grade 3 or more severe, or invasive cervical cancer. Immediate treatment did not reduce 3-year cancer risk, but was associated with more excisions yielding less serious findings, while delayed management reduced unnecessary procedures with careful follow-up. These findings may help inform U.S. guidelines on best management of CIN2. Prostate cancer screening is another topic of debate. The next article reports a study that found that Stockholm-3, a test that combines prostate-specific antigen levels with genetic, protein, and clinical data into a risk score, identified more clinically significant prostate cancers while missing fewer cases than standard PSA screening. Researchers from the Karolinska Institute conducted a secondary analysis of the baseline round of the Stockholm-3 MRI trial, a randomized trial of prostate cancer screening to identify clinically significant prostate cancer using a combination of risk prediction, MRI, and targeted prostate biopsies. The researchers analyzed data from more than 12,600 men ages 50 to 74 who underwent both PSA testing and the Stockholm-3 assessment. Men with abnormal results were assigned to biopsy strategies that included MRI imaging. Researchers tracked prostate cancer diagnoses over 2 years, focusing on clinically significant cases. They found that Stockholm-3 was more sensitive than PSA alone, detecting 90% of significant cancers compared to 74% with PSA, while maintaining similar specificity. Stockholm-3 also resulted in fewer missed cancers and a comparable number of unnecessary biopsies, suggesting Stockholm-3 provides a more favorable balance between detection of clinically significant prostate cancer and unnecessary biopsy. Effective and efficient ways to improve follow-up care for patients with poorly controlled type 2 diabetes are sorely needed, and the next article evaluated whether a nurse-led comprehensive telehealth program might be an effective strategy. Researchers from Duke University conducted a randomized trial of 220 patients with poorly controlled type 2 diabetes and comorbid hypertension across 6 academic primary care and endocrinology clinics to test whether a comprehensive telehealth program adapted for fee-for-service delivery could better manage adults with treatment-resistant chronic disease. Participants were assigned either to a self-monitoring control program or to a nurse-led telehealth intervention that included remote monitoring, self-management support, and medication management, both lasting 12 months. At the end of the study, both groups saw reductions in blood sugar levels, but there was no statistically or clinically significant difference between the groups. An accompanying editorial explores reasons why the strategy was not effective and provides suggestions for future pragmatic trials and interventions to improve the care of type 2 diabetes and other chronic diseases. The next article reports a study that examined how often antibiotics are prescribed for uncomplicated diverticulitis and whether practices have changed since the American Gastroenterological Association, American College of Physicians, and other professional societies recommended more selective antibiotic use. Researchers analyzed more than 33,000 emergency department and urgent care visits at 120 Veterans Affairs facilities between October 2015 and June 2025, using electronic health records to track prescribing trends. They found that antibiotics were given in 96.6% of visits overall, with little variation year to year, even as clinical guidelines advise that many patients may not benefit from their use. The authors conclude that prescribing patterns have not meaningfully aligned with evolving recommendations and suggest that targeted interventions may be needed to reduce unnecessary antibiotic use for diverticulitis. Although recommendations advise that COVID-19 and influenza vaccines can be administered on the same day, some patients are reluctant to do so because of concern about greater adverse events with co-administration. Researchers from Washington University in St. Louis conducted a target trial emulation, including 2.5 million patients in the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs healthcare system, between September 2022 and August 2025 to evaluate the 90-day risk for adverse events after co-administration of COVID-19 and influenza vaccines. They compared more than 700,000 people who received both vaccines at the same time with over 1.8 million who received only the influenza vaccine and examined 46 potential adverse events grouped by severity. The results showed that same-day vaccination of the COVID-19 and influenza vaccines did not increase the risk for cardiovascular and thrombotic events, neurological disorders, immune-mediated disorders, or other outcomes. The findings support the short-term safety of co-administration in adults and may help inform ongoing vaccine policy discussions. Next, researchers from the International Agency for Research on Cancer assessed lung cancer screening risk models in 641,830 Asian, Hispanic, non-Hispanic Black, and non-Hispanic white adults aged 50 to 80 years with a history of smoking. They found that many lung cancer prediction models underestimated risk for certain ethnic groups, including non-Hispanic Black individuals, and were less able to identify future lung cancers for Asian participants. Still, risk-based approaches overall may improve screening efficiency and make it more equitable compared to current guidelines. It is important to recognize that race and ethnicity are not biological factors, but may be population-level indicators of social factors not explicitly captured in the database used for the study. Bofengutide is a novel glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist not currently FDA-approved for use in the United States. A Phase 2b randomized clinical trial conducted in China evaluated the efficacy and safety of bofengutide for type 2 diabetes compared to semaglutide in 272 adults with type 2 diabetes. The results showed treatment with bofengutide led to meaningful reductions in hemoglobin A1c at 24 weeks. After 24 weeks, all bofengutide dosage groups saw meaningful reductions in blood sugar, weight loss, and improvements in various cardiometabolic risk factors. In some cases, the reductions were slightly greater than those seen with semaglutide. Gastrointestinal symptoms were more frequent with bofengutide, but were mostly mild. The findings suggest bofengutide may be an effective option for treatment of patients with type 2 diabetes, and further evaluation in ongoing phase 3 trials is warranted. In cirrhosis, non-selective beta blockers reduce hepatic portal pressure and have demonstrated benefit versus placebo for preventing hepatic decompensation. While carbidiol has emerged as a preferred non-selective beta blocker, direct evidence remains limited regarding its effectiveness for preventing decompensation and death versus other options. Using opt-in clinformatics data, the authors of the next article compared the effectiveness of initiating carbidiol versus nadolol or propranolol in adults with cirrhosis. The results of this observational study suggest that among U.S. patients with cirrhosis, carbidiol initiation, as opposed to initiation of nadolol or propranolol, was associated with meaningfully lower rates of major hepatic decompensation, supporting emerging prescribing patterns. Effective strategies for tapering long-term prescription opioids in outpatient settings are sorely needed. To identify such strategies, the authors of the next article conducted a randomized control trial in 562 adults with pain for greater than 6 months, taking greater than 10 morphine equivalents daily dose for greater than 3 months. Interventions compared were patient-centered tapering alone, tapering with close monitoring and electronic supports, tapering with cognitive behavioral therapy, and tapering plus a chronic pain self-management program. Unfortunately, the results showed that adding cognitive behavioral therapy or self-management to patient-centered opioid tapering did not improve taper success at 12 months. But cognitive behavioral therapy may reduce adverse events, including opioid withdrawal symptoms. Insufficient sleep is associated with obesity. However, the causal relationship between chronic, mildly insufficient sleep and weight, as well as variability by patient factors, remains unknown. To explore the impact of 6 weeks of 1.5 hours per night sleep restriction on energy balance and body weight regulation, The authors of the next article analyzed pooled data from two randomized crossover trials. Participants were adults 20 years and older at elevated cardiometabolic risk with habitual sleep of 7 or more hours per night. Outcome measures included weight, adiposity, waist circumference, energy balance behaviors, and biomarkers, including leptin. In sum, sleep restriction led to worsening of all measured outcomes. The authors conclude that prolonged exposure to moderately short sleep may lead to weight gain and suggest that weight management and cardiometabolic disease prevention programs should incorporate strategies to promote adequate sleep. Interhospital transfers are sometimes necessary to ensure access to appropriate levels of care, yet many transfers are potentially avoidable, leading to unnecessary resource use and patient burden. The next article systematically reviewed published evidence that explored the association between telemedicine and interhospital transfer rates among patients considered for an interhospital transfer. The authors found 33 eligible studies that compared usual transfer discussions with those incorporating telemedicine. The studies were too heterogeneous for quantitative analysis, but appeared to show that telemedicine was commonly associated with lower transfer rates in adult and pediatric populations. The authors conclude that telemedicine may support appropriate triage and reduce potentially avoidable interhospital transfers with no adverse association on patient mortality. Benzodiazepines are frequently prescribed in older adults for anxiety and insomnia, despite risks that include falls, motor vehicle crashes, and cognitive impairment. Long-term care residents are particularly vulnerable to these adverse effects due to frailty and multimorbidity. To examine national trends from 2015 to 2024 in benzodiazepine prescription for U.S. adults aged 65 years and older, researchers analyzed prescription claims that captured over 90% of retail and 75 to 80% of long-term care pharmacy fills. From 2015 through 2024, overall benzodiazepine use declined from 14.1 to 11.5 per 100 persons. However, over 24 million older adults filled one or more benzodiazepine prescriptions. Prescribing by advanced practice clinicians increased from 14.3% to 30.1%, while primary care physicians prescribing decreased from 68.3% to 56.6%. Roughly one-third of older adults filling benzodiazepine prescriptions had long-term use. Benzodiazepine use among older U.S. adults declined before COVID-19 but plateaued thereafter, with increases among adults 75 years and older and those in long-term care. The authors speculate that identifying drivers of these trends could inform safer management of anxiety and insomnia in this population. If you go to annals.org, you'll find two new articles summarizing a National Institute of Health workshop on leveraging real-world evidence to inform regulatory, clinical, and coverage decisions related to glucagon-like peptide 1-based therapies. Also new is a research and reporting methods article on incorporating stakeholder engagement in clinical guideline development, a commentary on Medicare's Bridge program to provide access to GLP-1 receptor agonists for weight management, and an interesting commentary discussing the record number of physicians currently running for political office. Last is an IM Matters news article about how artificial intelligence is affecting medical journals that includes interviews with editors affiliated with Annals, JAMA, and the Journal of General Internal Medicine. That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll go to annals.org for a close look at some of the new material I've highlighted here. Thanks to Beth Jenkinson, Andrew Langman, and Bernie Turner for their technical support.